Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
For more than 200 years, a small office has operated on the state floor of the White House executive residence. Known as the Usher's Office, its mission is to accommodate the personal needs of the first family. He or she is the individual who spends an enormous amount of time, not just around the president's family, but the president, him or herself. My guest today is Christopher Emery, the former White House usher for Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. He served 29 years in the federal government, maintaining a top secret clearance while working for the White House, U.S. Congress, Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Justice. Today, he's a published author of two books, his memoir, White House Usher, Stories from the Inside, which details his time managing the White House, and his latest wonderful mystery novel entitled White House Usher, Who Killed the President? Chris is going to join us, and boy, is that going to be a fun conversation coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, you know, every once in a while, folks, you get that blast from the past that, and you go down memory lane and you remember old friendships and the battles and the drinks after the battles. And it's really one of those moments for me to welcome an old friend to the podcast, Chris Emery, noted author, former White House usher, all around just a good guy. Welcome, man.
Michael, great to see you.
It's so good seeing you.
You speak of battles. I don't know that we lost any.
No, we didn't. That's so true. We did not. We won governorships and legislative races, and we did all kinds of good things and a lot of fun. And it's so nice to see you. And it's nice to be able to talk about your success as someone who's been inside the room where it happened and be a part of America's story and history in the way that you served both presidents and the country. And I just find that very, very compelling. You've got a new book out, which we're going to get into, White House Usher, White House Usher's Who Killed the President? Stories from the Inside is the first book, but the latest is Who Killed the President? But let's start at the beginning, because that's always a good place to sort of give people a feel for Chris Emery and your narrative. You were a White House usher, which is a job that a lot of people don't know exists, correct? Right? Tell us about that part of your story, how you became an usher. What is a White House usher? Right. You know, and how does it all kind of weave itself in and out of the story of presidents?
Well, absolutely. And Michael, I realized this the other day, and I don't know what made me think of it, but I am a real White House insider.
Yes, you are.
More so than anybody else that says they are, which hopefully after this, everyone will understand why. But the usher's office is a very unique, rare office that's inside the White House. It's been around for almost 200 years. And it is actually the management office for the White House, the home of the first family, and the 18 acres of grounds that surround the house. And the ushers are there to primarily make that building feel like a home to the first family, not an office and not a museum. Mm-hmm. The ushers, and I happen to be the 18th one in history. So they stay around for a while.
They stay around a while, yeah.
But I spent just over eight years in the White House. I worked for President Reagan, President H.W. Bush, and President Clinton. And I just had the most amazing job in the world. My job was to take care of the personal needs of the president and first family.
Right.
And the office, as I said, has been around for 200 years. The name Usher really derived from pre-colonial England. The ushers were the men that took care of the great estates of the rich and famous people that lived in England at the time. So fast forward quite a while till when that was created. It was actually in the first floor plan of the White House in 1792, actually. There was something called the Porter's Lodge, which became the usher's office.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say I was the 18th, there were actually the 18th, that count starts from about 1845. So it's just an amazing job where we have a daily interaction with the first family. I get calls from the president for anything. It could be, you know, cancel my trip to Camp David this weekend, or hey, you know what? I got the Baltimore Orioles. I want them to come play some, you know, catch on the South grounds.
Right.
Set it up.
Make it happen.
But it's the most amazing job that really is, and there's not much about written about it or known about it, because that's the privacy of the first family is paramount. And as far as ushers go, there have been three others that have written books. I happen to be the first one that's written two books.
Mm-hmm.
But in the history of the White House, it's a very closed for security and for privacy reasons. There's not much known about the house.
What? So you've had three presidents that you were there for: Reagan, Bush 41, and Clinton. Each of those individuals, and certainly their first ladies, mm-hmm. And families writ large, were very different. You know, you take a Nancy Reagan on one end and a Hillary Clinton on the other, and then you put in Barbara Bush, who everybody who knew Barbara Bush knew, yeah, you don't mess with mama, right? Yeah, she was just that kind of very protective of her husband and the family, for sure. How would you assess the personalities of the House under each of those presidents and first ladies?
Well, it's very different. Fortunately for President Reagan, you know, it's really interesting. Reagan, being older, had much older department secretaries and directors and assistants. And I'll explain why I point that out. The Reagans were old Hollywood.
Right.
They entertain. I mean, I met Frank Sinatra. I met Jimmy Stewart. I met Gregory Peck. I mean, that was the crowd that they hung out with. It was pretty
right.
Cool. So, and the Reagans loved older music. They like Hodge and Hart, you know, 1930 kind of thing. Whereas, you know, when President Bush came in, he was younger. Also more into, as far as the celebrities, it was more into like athletics, you know, Nolan Ryan.
Right.
You know, Herschel Walker, when he was a football player, or after he was a football player, Chrissy Everett, things like that. And the Bushes were a little more active. I should back up a little bit there. You know, President Reagan went to bed late and got up at a reasonable time, and he was in the Oval Office after 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
There were times I would take the schedule up to the president late at night, and he'd be there, President Reagan, in his big government issue black glasses, wearing a robe, with a pile of papers on his lap that he's going through. And he was working till, you know, 10, 11 at night. President Bush, on the other hand, would get up at 5 in the morning, and he'd read 5 newspapers and then have his coffee. And it was just a little more active, he was a little more, you know, the day started earlier.
Right.
With the Clintons, and the Clintons being much younger, they were more into the 90210 era of celebrities.
Right, like right.
But they knew how to have fun. They had a lot of parties. And being younger, they had younger friends, and it was a very different White House. But the point I make about Reagan having an older staff, you know, Michael, it was Reagan's staff were there for one reason, President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
They were there for the guy, and that's all they thought about. The Bush folks came in, they're a little younger, and some of them are starting to think, hey, you know what? I could have a real career after this.
Right.
And so the focus wasn't so much on the president.
Interesting.
A little bit on them. The Clinton folks got in. It was, I got to tell you, it was absolute chaos because they were very young. And nobody really knew the goals or the mission until David Gergen came in. And you see David Gergen occasionally now.
Yeah.
Gergen came in, and he was what was really needed in that White House, you know, an adult. And he kind of got things focused a little bit for the president. But you had guys like Paul Begala. You had George Stephanopoulos. And then, of course, our friend, the guy, Mary Madeline's husband.
Carville.
And you had those three guys who were brilliant for the Clintons, but they were crazy. And so, you know, with that brilliance and energy came some missteps now and then. But those are the primary differences between the first families. And I should back up to George H.W. Bush. Now, I spent all 4 years that he was president working for him. So I got to know the Bush family a lot better. Mrs. Bush, who was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
It was very close. And so it was tough when they left. And I have to say that, the Clintons brought in new energy and new goals and a little bit of chaos. The Reagans were pretty stable.
It creates an interesting political narrative, because a lot of what you're describing is also a lot how their administrations kind of played out. Mm-hmm. Reagan's were sort of, you know, they were considered like the imperial presidency. They sort of brought back this regalness and this sort of formality. The Bushes were more patrician, but, you know, kind of cool. You know, they hung out with a lot of the folks that were, you know, sort of staples in various areas of economy and politics and sports that people really felt comfortable. And that kind of translated into Bush 43 as well, you know, sort of mm-hmm. the everyman thing, even though you did have this sort of upper New England kind of, you know, sort of chin up approach. And the Clintons were like, you know, hey, y'all, we're the party. We're here. I brought some Ripple, you know, and it's kind of how their administrations played out. And so behind the scenes, you have these stories that involve. What are some of your favorite stories about each of these presidents and how, because I presume in some respects, and I'm not, you know, trying to be chauvinistic or anything like that, but typically the first lady is kind of running the White House, right? She's kind of running the show around the president. Certainly we knew that about Nancy Reagan, very protective about his scheduling, his time, who came in, who didn't. And I assume that translated into events at the White House from very casual to very formal.
Right.
What are some of the stories that you remember about those times that, again, not wanting to breach any privacy or family secrets, although mm-hmm. that would be good. I'm not gonna stop you from doing that. But you've written a lot about it, and you've talked a lot about those events. Share some of those with us.
Sure. Well, my first book, Stories from the Inside, is really a memoir about my time. It'll teach people about the usher's office, the day-to-day operation. And there's some anecdotes and some great things I've included in there, but there's nothing in that book that would ever embarrass anybody in any first family. You know, Michael, I had offers from publishers, which won't be named, that offered me a six-figure advance, and then they told me what I would write.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I explained, well, that's not really what this is about. I want to write a nice book about what this, the function of this strange, obscure office and what they do and some of the neat things that we got involved with. I think each president and I have different stories, and I've cherished some of the private time with those, each, all three.
Right.
And that'll never see the light of day. I'm never going to talk about any of that. But the, you know, President Reagan was bigger than life. I mean, his stature, I mean, for a man that age, much younger than our current president, but he actually was really in shape. And a lot of people don't realize after
this guy was still splitting wood back at his, yes, at his ranch.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. Well, after he was the assassination attempt where the bullet just missed his heart.
Right.
One of the things they put him on was a heavy regimen of weightlifting. And so we had a universal gym right above the usher's office. And above the usher's office is the private residence. And by the way, if you've been in the White House, if you've been on that 8-minute tour, because they push you through pretty quick,
right
before you leave the front door to go out in the North Portico, if you look right to your left,
right
to your left, behind that mahogany door with those mirrored windows, that's the usher's office. So we're right, we're the last office serving the president that's still located in the actual house of the president. In
right.
The house itself. So I was telling about the universal gym. I could hear from my office, I could hear the clanking of when he was doing bench presses. And, you know, I had a full universal gym with all the apparatus. And the universal gyms were, you know, what was it, 1970s, I guess. Replaced by all this really cool stuff now. But the reason I'm telling you this story, President Reagan increased his shirt size by 3 sizes.
Really?
Because the mass, his chest was big and his shoulders were big. It's amazing.
Wow.
So he was in great shape. But which actually ended up being a problem for him, because when he had Alzheimer's, sadly, it took longer for him to die because he was physically, he was in such great shape.
He was in good shape, yeah.
Yeah. But back to special moments, and I write about a lot of them in my book, but probably the most special moment I ever had was 1 week after George Bush lost to Bill Clinton. It was exactly 1 week later. It was Veterans Day. And President and I, as we often would do, and First Ladies, we were walking around the South grounds. There's a driveway that goes around the South lawn.
Mm-hmm.
It was dark. And the president would say, hey, walk with me. And, you know, talk about baseball. You talk about a lot of things. This particular night, he said, I want to go to the Vietnam Memorial tonight. It's the 10th anniversary of the Vietnam Memorial. And he says, you know, they read names. There's spouses of the guys that lost their life there.
Right.
They read their names at a podium at the wall. And I said, well, that sounds nice. And he says, I don't want to show up the new guy. I just looked at him because I don't want any press. I don't want anybody knowing I'm doing this because I'm doing it for me. And I don't want to do anything that's going to make headlines over the new president. So I said, that sounds wonderful. And there was an agent walking 4 feet behind us. He called the agent up. He said, hey, I want to go to the Vietnam Memorial at midnight, the anniversary of the wall. And I don't want a motorcade. I just, you know, one car, 2 cars max. And the agent said, yes, sir, I'll bring a team in. And the president looked at him and said, no, you're not bringing a team in. Look, he said to the guy, what would you do if I had a heart attack? Are you going to wait to bring a team in? And the agent said, no, sir. He said, good, set it up. So typically my hours, I cover the awake hours of the president. And with the Reagans, it was always really easy if you're working nights because right. They went to bed at 10:30 and was done. The Bushes varied a little bit, and the Clintons. Bill Clinton would be up till 3 a.m. So back to President Bush. So he goes back inside, and I'm doing some stuff in my office, and normally I'm gone at 10 o'clock because they'll call me up, and Mrs. Bush will say, go home to your family.
Right.
Out of here. And there's some things I do to shut down the White House, and I go home. I'm on call that night. So about 12:45, I hear the elevator go up to the private residence. So I run out and I get in the elevator because it automatically opens on the floor next to the usher's office as a security mm-hmm. measure. So there's a 10-second stop where I jump in the elevator and I get up and I go up the elevator. Mrs. Bush comes and the president are there. And Mrs. Bush comes on the elevator. She goes, what are you still doing here? And I said, oh, I've got all kinds of work I've been working on in my office. And she just rolled her eyes. And she says, do you know what Pops wants to do? President Bush. I said, yes, I do. And she says, we're going to go to the walk. I said, that's great. So before we do that, we're going to take a walk. I said, okay. So I just walked out and stood at the South Portico outside on the driveway while they walked. I wanted them to have their freedom. I didn't always wanted to walk with them, right?
Right.
So they do one lap and they come around and they're going to do another lap. Mrs. Bush looks at me and says, would you like to come with us? And I didn't know if she meant walk around the driveway or come with them to the Vietnam Memorial.
Right.
So she meant the memorial. And I said, oh my gosh, yes, I'd love to. So we walk up, there's two cars, and I figure I'm in the backup car with the agents. I start hanging that way. She goes, no, you're riding with us.
Wow.
And so they get in the car in the back seat of the giant Lincoln, and there's a little flip seat, jump seat.
Yeah.
Yep. Behind the passenger.
Yep.
I see. She flips it down. She goes, sit here. So I was knee to knee with them as we're driving. The only disappointment I had is they didn't use lights or sirens.
All right. That's the look, as a native Washingtonian, you live for the lights and sirens, yes. Folks. That's a motorcade. That's when you got, when you know you are in the moment. That's
So we go out to the White House very quietly. We go down and I tell them, I said, this will be my first time to the memorial. And he looked at me and said, oh my gosh, we can't believe you haven't been there. So we get to the get up to the Lincoln Memorial and we return and we park and they get out. Now the president's wearing a leather aviator jacket. Really looks cool. Mrs. Bush is wearing a black raincoat. It was cool, but not cold. There was no moon, no stars, and there's no press lights. So you've got this couple, and I gave them like 5 feet in front of me.
Right.
And they're walking towards the memorial. And the president sees all these guys walking, these vets. They're wearing, you know, denim, and they got all kinds of leather and stuff and chains. And they're walking away. They're kind of a rough crew. And he's saying as they walk by, he goes, thanks for what you did. And they just keep walking. And one guy, he slaps one guy on the back. And this guy turns around like he's annoyed. Who? And then he realizes, because by the time the guy got even with me, because I was walking, right, he's telling his buddies, that's the president. So the president makes it up to the stage. There's maybe 200 or 300 people in the audience. And he asks this lady, and she was so honored to have him read the name of her husband. She was getting ready to read it. So she gave him the sheet and he read 10 names and then they exited. And by the time they got to the other side of the stage, there was a big crowd lined up. You know, these vets wanted to
Sure.
So the president's signing autographs. And I remember this one guy came up in a wheelchair and he had a big red beard. And he asked the president, would you sign my vest, my denim vest? And the president said, sure. And I remember the president saying, if you can move your beard 2 inches. So we get back in the limo. We're going to go back to the White House. And they're talking a little bit. But the president's kind of lost. You know, he's kind of staring. And actually, I saw a tear running down his cheek. And we're leaving the scene. And Mrs. Bush is saying, and they just that evening before this, they'd gone to Union Station where Bob Dole, Senator Dole,
right,
had a big ceremony for the president. And so Mrs. Bush says to her husband, she goes, tell Chris about all the nice things Bob Dole said about you tonight. And the president's just looking out the window. He's ignoring her. And then she looks at him and sees what's going on. She looks at me. She goes, okay, I'll tell him. So that was the... I think that was the first time I'd ever gone anywhere outside of the White House with the president and first lady. And so we got back. It was, you know, 12:30 at night or almost, it was late. And
what do you miss about those times? What do you miss about, I mean, moments like that obviously are profoundly compelling in how you see the worth of your work. And the appreciation of that work by the first family, because it is a very personal service that you provide.
It is
on behalf of the country. How do you what do you miss about it? And when you sit back and reflect on it now, what do you think about those times?
Well, I was so fortunate to be in situations where I get to witness things that no normal human gets to see. And I guess, Michael, you know, I've spent many years in project management and all these things after the White House, and where you have these project deadlines, there's a lot of pressure. Well, at the White House, the pressure is immediate. The pressure is immediate when President Reagan calls me and says, General Scowcroft or General Crow is coming over and he needs an easel. Whenever Crow needed an easel, somebody was going to get bombed. So, but that's just a little example of how immediate you have to respond. And there's never a no to the president or first lady. Said, we will get it done. And just having kind of being on edge like that is actually very invigorating. So I miss that. I miss being able to help, you know, make a difference. And it was kind of like, you know, I'm the guy in the shadows that gets things done. So
were there scary moments in those shadows? I mean, I can imagine the day Reagan was shot. Well, you were there after that.
I think, during the Gulf War, you know, we went 24/7. We were there all night. And I was taking situation room bulletins up to the president.
Right.
And when the Scuds started hitting, going towards Israel, remember the president, you know, this was 1990s. This is how far back the technology was. So I'm flipping from CNN in my office in the ushers. I'm flipping from CNN to CBS. I'm getting all the news.
Right.
And I'm upstairs talking to the president. He goes, what's the latest report on the Scuds? And I said, well, I can tell you what CNN and CBS are saying, because that's what I want to hear. So, I mean, the president's got his total security staff. He's got the Joint Chiefs. He's got the Pentagon. And he's asking me, what's the latest on the Scuds? But times like that were, it was tough because we were in a war situation. But what was really tough was seeing the price it took on the president, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't sleep. And the toll, I should say, that it took on him. It was really, really difficult.
Are there any, so now you've got, and I want to get, because I think it kind of sets up what you've done narratively with the new book, which is a wonderful murder mystery and, you know, all the intrigue of, you know, dark, wet streets in Washington, D.C., which I want to get into, but and the reason I want to have this conversation first, because I think it animates what you write next in the new book. So folks knowing the intricate details and background and experiences inside the White House, it gives not just color, but texture to the story in who killed the president.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at that time and you're writing for this time, what do you see as outdated now? I mean, things, protocols, procedures, you've mentioned the technology, you know, today we've got a cell phone that you could have said, well, Mr. President, here, take a look, right?
Right.
Then you were like, well, CNN said, or you know, they just reported on ABC or CBS, because there was no MSNBC or no Fox at that time.
Right.
What seems outdated to you when you look back on that now?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me respond this way and see if this helps. The White House thrives on the unknown as far as the security of the complex and what the capabilities are. And in fact, I touch a little bit on that in this book, Who Killed the President. I think a lot of the technology's been improved, but some of the procedures haven't been. And I was standing next to what was Clinton's Treasury Secretary from Texas. He ran for president. I was standing next to him after the plane that crashed. This was years ago. There was a plane, a kid crashed a plane into the White House.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Was it Benson? No, it wasn't Benson. What was his name? But anyway, I'm standing next to the secretary. And at that time, this is before Homeland Security, so Treasury was in charge of the Secret Service.
Right.
And Lloyd
Benson.
Yeah, Benson, I think.
All right,
so
Benson.
The press are yelling questions. Mr. Secretary, how close did the White House come to launching their missiles, you know, anti-aircraft missiles? And he said it was under consideration. And I'm looking at him and said, there ain't no missiles up there. Hey, there might be now. I was there a long time ago, but I'm saying
missiles up there.
So my point is, and the Secret Service told me, it says, yeah, the outside, they just fear, they don't know our capabilities. And we thrive on that. Because
a lot of that obviously changes after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so there are those elements and aspects of it that make it that much more intriguing how we dealt with and existed with threats back then,
right,
in the late 80s, 90s, and how we exist and deal with those threats today. And particularly those threats to the president, which we want to get into in the new book. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to author and former White House usher, Christopher Emery. More with Chris right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I love these Washington conversations, this inside Washington stuff, because having grown up in the city, literally about 4 or 5 miles from the White House, that was always part of my playground. My dad, every time we drove by the White House, he never failed to stop, slow down in front of the White House. You could do that then in what is now the plaza in front of the White House, and get out and take me to the fence and show me where the president lived. So I've always had this kind of really interesting intrigue and insight about the building and the people in the building. And you've now written a book, your second, White House Usher Who Killed the President, in which you sort of bring a lot of that intrigue right to the table, which I love. So just to give folks a flavor of, here's the plot as Chris has set it up. The world is rocked by the sudden death of the President of the United States. Almost a shocking detail soon emerged, implicating a member of the White House Usher's office. The evidence seems overwhelming, and the case is soon considered as open and shut. If only the rest of the world knew how much more was going on behind the scenes. Now, read how Chief Usher Bartholomew Winston, a 50-year veteran of the White House, works with investigators to uncover the truth, even if that means diving headfirst into dangerous political waters to find it. Ah, I love a good dangerous water story in D.C. It is so much fun. Tell us about this book. And what inspired the thinking behind it? I love the backdrop. As you just described, the closeness of the White House usher to the first family, mm-hmm. the role they play, and then to suddenly have in this book the principal suspect be possibly the usher himself.
Oh, I had so much fun with this. And it really is a whodunit, okay? Okay, I'll give you one hint. The usher didn't do it, okay? I loved writing this because it was pure imagination with fact of knowledge of what goes on inside the White House. And by the way, I should mention, all the scenes in the White House are absolutely authentic. Now, the characters are fiction.
Wow. Okay.
But everything that takes place is exactly how the protocol. There's even a scene where I'm not giving away too much, where an assistant usher is asked by the vice president, a female, at a state dinner. She's kind of bored at this dinner. And she says, "I've got a challenge for you." And he goes, I love challenges. She goes, get me out of the White House without anybody knowing. And he does.
And he does.
And that's in the book.
Did that actually happen at some point?
That I can't say, but the way it was done was possible, and at least in the time I was at the White House, I'm sure they've corrected all these things, right?
Right.
But the book is so much fun. There's lots of twists and turns. There's a lot of action. There's some foreign entities involved where you might expect, and it's just I absolutely adore the characters. Bartholomew Winston, for example, fabulous character. He has uncanny resemblance to Morgan Freeman.
Ah, okay.
Which actually, there's a story I write in here that he's at the social office in the Reagan White House decided to have Winston, everybody calls him Winston, come to a party, a private party that Reagan's would have, and just walk around with a drink, because everybody would think he was Morgan Freeman. So he does this, but the trick was on him because Morgan Freeman was invited to the party.
Was actually there.
So there's a lot of lighthearted fun in this book, but it's obviously very serious. The president's actually been assassinated. He was poisoned in the White House. And, you know, everybody from the usher to the chef to others or the White House physician to others are considered as suspects. And, of course, there's this group led by Winston that's working with a couple other folks trying to really find out what happened. And it's very exciting. I've gotten good reviews on it.
No, that's great. I'm already thinking I can't wait to see the movie because
great movie.
Or the Netflix series, you know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, you know, Winston had become, you know, White House usher by day, detective by night kind of deal.
I should mention I'm now working on Who Shot the Speaker.
Who Shot the Speaker?
And that'll be out this year. And that's also another whodunit. And some of the same characters make it's almost a sequel. I mean, some of the same characters are in both books. So
interesting. Sort of playing off of the resolution of that, which had a sort of tail wagging in another direction towards the
but,
speaker.
You know, Michael, I spent 8 years in the White House. I spent 8 years on Capitol Hill. And when I was on Capitol Hill with the architect of the Capitol, we were also responsible for the Supreme Court.
Right.
So there's a pattern to my book writing. You know, we got who killed the president, who shot the speaker. Next one's going to be who killed the chief justice.
Interesting. Yeah. And there, you know, that's a hot topic in our politics today, which, you know, really speaks to, you know, the nature of our politics. And when you look at, for example, your experience as an usher, the writing of the story, which sort of details in the context of a whodunit, the day in the life of the individuals in that work in the White House, who are part of the president's retinue, who are part of his security and all of that. How did you see? Because we have mutual friends who were still in the White House during the Trump years, which was a very kind of topsy-turvy experience, probably a lot like Clinton's in one sense, but not so much in another, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. A lot like in the sense that this was very different, you know, particularly given the sort of staid kind of traditional approach of the Obamas, and then you've got Clinton. I mean, you've got Trump, very much the staid traditions of, you know, Reagan and Bush. And then you've got Clinton, who was kind of like, you know, a good old boy. And like you said, a younger sort of vibe and all of that. How did you see that? What were some of the concerns, scariness, or just, you know, operationalizing the day-to-day for the first family for a president who was so asymmetrical in his presidency?
It's really tough. And I figured out the other day that there's still one person left that I was there. I left there 29 years ago.
Wow.
There's still one person left from when I was there. You know, the staff is so professional, and that comes out actually in the murder mystery. You'll see a lot of the staff interacting with the new president, which happens to be a woman. So you see, they're very professional. And actually, you know, I've met seven presidents, and I've actually worked with folks. There was a guy in the White House when I was there that worked, remembers seeing FDR and Churchill in the Rose Garden.
Wow. Wow.
But it's wow. It's interesting because he was a great guy, and asking him, you know, who's your favorite? And, you know, the pretty much favorite over the years was Truman. Everybody kind of liked him because he was easy and played cards, and, you know, he's
right.
And some of the other, you know, the Camelot, the Kennedys, the staff weren't that crazy about him. They were a little aloof.
Interesting.
And Johnson, you know, Johnson was just, man, he was tough. A little story. Eisenhower had the farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, right, that he'd go to. He would ask the carpenters and electricians and plumbers if they had time, if they could come up and help him with some stuff, and he'd pay him. President Johnson did the same thing, although he didn't ask. He said, you'll be at my ranch in Texas. And he didn't pay him. But each of the families are so different. But
yeah, difference between Democrats and Republicans, right?
That's a good example, actually. You know, the staff and some of the, like the butlers are the front line. Those are the guys in the trenches that are always up there with the family. And, you know, they have feelings, they have opinions, but you would never know it. And we never talk about stuff like that. So it's just, you know, we serve the president, and yes, you know, there was a butler named George Haney who once joked with Mrs. Bush, says, presidents come and go, but George Haney will always be here.
Well, and there is a truth to that. There's a real truth to that. Because there are these men and women who serve and have served for a long time. And you know, I think that was part of the movie The Butler, and you know, how these individuals' lives, yeah, revolve around the president and the first lady and their families, but also how those individuals, presidents and first ladies and their families, revolve around individuals like yourself. Yeah. Like you described that moment with Barbara Bush, like, hey, you want to come with us?
Yeah.
And that's a very special, intimate moment. That's just not Barbara being, oh, let me just be nice and make an offer. There is an appreciation of the fact that you are with them and you're part of their life in that house. And there'd be no different than if an in-law or a cousin came and stayed with them. You know, you become part of the family in many respects. Do you find that? How do people in your position appreciate or not appreciate that? I mean, do some people just say, hey, it's a job, I do it? And are others like really get wrapped up in the moment with the first family?
I think everybody stays very involved. I don't know if there's ever any normalcy to this thing. But you're always, you know, and not all staff are accepted by first families as we
know. Yeah, I can imagine.
I went to a...
Got any good stories there?
Yeah, I'll be happy to share one. It's in my memoir. But I went to Marlon Fitzwater's book signing. He wrote one of his last books. And Marlon is with a former press secretary.
Right. Great guy.
Well, I got there and I was a little timid because I hadn't seen these guys in a long time. And I see Marvin Bush, who was the closest to my age, and we had fun in the White House. He's talking to four or five people, and I'm standing off in the distance, and he sees me and he stops talking and he says to the crew, he goes, I want you to meet my mother's favorite son.
Wow.
And he brought me over.
You beat out Jeb, huh? There you go.
But I think, you know, the certainly the staff of the butlers and the ushers, and so the butlers work for the ushers. So, you know, right, they're the ones with the all the full time access and often time access. And yeah, it takes a special person to be able to adapt and adjust And
so is the president in Who Killed the President, a compilation of the presidents that you've worked for?
Yes. Well,
how is that character formed? What attributes can you point to say, yeah, she's a little bit like Clinton here and a little bit like Bush there, et cetera?
Well, I can tell you this, the president that was assassinated was a very Reagan-like. He had a big problem with the Soviets and now the Russians, and he was his polling numbers were very good. That's discussed in the book. The vice president, very young, dynamic, who happens to look a little bit like Demi Moore.
Uh-huh.
Her polling numbers are outstanding, and she's a rock star. I mean, she's a Naval Academy grad. She was a pilot. She's a three-term congresswoman. And she's a dynamic speaker, wildly popular on both sides. I mean, they just love her. And but you get to see the real person, and she has a very big dark side,
right?
As you learn in this book. And she's I'm not answering your question because you asked me which president would that person remind me of. I would probably say it reminds me of someone that never became president but lived in the White House.
Interesting.
The first lady, actually. Yeah. Mrs. Clinton. A little bit of Mrs. Clinton. As you read the book, you'll see, you'll be very interested in this character. I'm not going to say you're going to admire this person, but you're going to be surprised by what you learn.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, look, I'm all stoked and excited about reading it, and I'm really excited that you could come on and share a little bit of the insights to this story, because it really is not just a murder mystery whodunit, but it really is kind of an ongoing narrative of your work in the White House in behalf of the American people, and as you know, sharing the protocols and the sort of that other side of the relationship with these important figures and how human they are and how much they get caught up in things. And to be a witness to that is fascinating as hell, man. That is just an amazing, amazing story to be able to tell that.
I was really lucky. My whole career.
How did you get the job?
People always
your
say
your background is your back. I mean, you weren't groomed to be the usher at the White House.
So. No, I was in information technology.
Yeah, I thought you were back in. You were a tech guy back in the day.
So I was actually working in Greenbelt, Maryland, and one day as a programmer, they call them coders now. They even changed the name, but I was writing computer programs, and I had a copy of the Washington Post from the previous Sunday, and I'm just looking at it at lunchtime. I see this ad and I say, Executive Office of the President, Office of Administration, Reagan White House, in search of computer automation specialist. And I'm thinking, man, I've got to get a rejection letter from the White House. How cool would that be? Right? I actually printed out my resume, and this was 1985. So it was on a dot matrix printer. I still have it. I found it in the archives. The letter. And my letter was all in caps.
No.
Yeah. So I mailed.
But you were screaming your qualifications to the president.
So this was August 85, or September or August of 85. I mailed it in, and I was thinking, I can't wait to get this letter because I'm going to show my buddies in the office. Look who's writing to me, right? Oh, I wouldn't let them see the letter, just the letterhead, the White House. So I forgot about it until December one day when the phone rang at home. We're at dinner and my stepdaughter answers the phone. Her eyes get really big as she hands me the phone. The phone's one of those wall phones,
I remember with the long cord. Yeah.
She hands me the phone and she says, it's the White House. I'm thinking, what? So I thought, who should I answer this as? I could be Arnold Schwarzenegger. I could do a funny, this is Jimmy Carter. I could do somebody or Ronald Reagan. I answered, hi, this is Chris Emery. And the lady started reading for my resume. And I thought, this is real.
I love it.
So I interviewed, this was in December. I interviewed early January and they hired me. And I started mid-January 1986. And For the first year, I was in the office of the president, and then I ended up getting into the job where I managed the White House residence, the home of the first family.
Right.
Because they had an opening, and I was doing some work over there, and I ended up getting that job. But yeah, everybody says, "Who'd you know to get your job?" And I said, "I didn't know anybody."
Right. I just sent in a resume because I saw an ad in the newspaper.
So my plan for a joke backfired. I never got the rejection letter.
Yeah, but you got a little bit better than that, right? And that's how a good story ends. That is wonderful, man. Well, Chris, I appreciate you coming on, man, and taking some time with us and sharing the insights. The book is White House Usher, Who Killed the President? It's out now. Grab a copy, sit back with a glass of vino and enjoy it. It is a great Washington whodunit. You guys will love it. You can follow Chris on Twitter at White House Usher. And, track some of the things he's doing as he's getting ready to write a new book or is in the process of writing a new one.
I'm a third of the way through it. And I was working on it right before we started this call. So I should mention my book is also available. The murder mystery is also available in Audible.
The reason
I pushed that is there's so many characters in this book and the narrator was so good. There's a scene in my book that I actually flash back to something that occurred in the Nixon White House. It's a great story, which is true. But the narrator does Nixon better than Nixon. I mean, this guy is great. So if you like Audible, if you're driving a lot or, walking a lot, get the Audible version. As you mentioned, my first book's in Audible also.
Yep. And I was going to say the first book that started the storyline was White House Usher, Stories from the Inside by Chris Emery. Check out both books. Get the Audible. I love the Audible too. I love particularly when you've got good narration.
Yeah,
it just draws you further into it, and you actually feel like you're talking or at least listening to the candidates mm-hmm. to the characters in the book. So, but Chris, I wish you all the best with it, man.
Thank you.
And keep writing, and we'll keep reading.
I really appreciate it, Michael. I'm so glad to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too. You take care of yourself.
All right.
Folks, that does it for our little bit of time together. I really hope you got a lot out of this. It was a great conversation with Chris Emery. Again, check out the book, White House Usher, Who Killed the President. It's out now. Get the Audible version as well if you like that. And, check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele, the podcast, at Steele_podcast. And do the download thing. Tell your friends about what we're doing over here. We're having a lot of fun. It's just good conversation and every once in a while, I would like to bring some stuff that you otherwise wouldn't know about or hear about. And this is one of those because it's good stuff out there. And we want you to be a part of at least understanding the rest of the story. And Chris has got some good stories to tell, and it's all in the book. So until next time, be safe, be well, and God bless.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.